Hello and welcome to Dice Punks, a tabletop role-playing podcast where we focus on playing full campaigns in less well-known systems. This week in episode 13, our nobilis seek to learn about Dia Macor, Nyx, what's wrong with fury in this land across the sea, all while trying not to be devoured. Hello and welcome. I'm Adam, your friendly neighborhood game master, and joining me are...
Hello, I'm Drew, and I'll be playing Dask Tyr, the reticent regal of nothing.
Hi, I'm Robin, and I'll be playing the body blacksmith Lissa Crate, aka the Duchess of Fury.
Excellent. Before we get started, let's briefly recap any character stat growth and the events of the previous episode for ourselves and our listeners. I don't believe we have any character stat growth this time, unless...
I'm poor, so no. And in XP, but not in experience, if that distinction makes sense.
Yeah, I figured we had mostly spent our savings in the previous couple of episodes. So, in that case... Dask can fill us in on the events of last time. Take it away.
Well, first thing, we were roused from the inn, and indeed from the town, along with the rest of the town, to the edge of the woods by the town, where we'd been staying, en route to our destination. And, well, we came upon a bear beast the size of a house, which, to my understanding, is bigger than a typical bear beast. Lissa and I were able to subdue this wondrous thing by miraculous means, and then out of the sky came Apatia, who told us the bear beast's name was Ivy, and who went on to tell us little else, save that her domain is sensation. She took Lissa up on her offer of a drink, though perhaps in a different sense than, well, certainly than I expected. She drank some of her blood, but not mine, which is fine, obviously. We put Ivy, now a human rather than a bear beast, to bed in our rooms at the inn, and then saw Apatia hanging outside our window. I don't know what, given that, I expected her to say, but I know I didn't expect her to say what she did say, namely, hello, delicious friends.
Minor correction on the end there. It was definitely friend singular.
Ooh, good call. Good call.
Which, you know, is a good segue, I think, into resuming here. It is the small hours of the morning. I have already apprised my players of this, but folks at home, I realized the necessity recently of having an in-universe calendar. So we are going to be starting today in the early morning hours of Kauna, the 24th of Winnow, 784 on the Taraxan City's calendar. If you can't hold that in your minds, players and listeners, that's fine. I will be keeping track of it. But that way we just can have points of reference on a timeline as this campaign spools out. Hopefully it doesn't spin out.
If it does, then expect to blame me.
I appreciate you volunteering there, because boy will I need to do some ass covering in that case. So Lissa is asleep. Ivy has not stirred much since you retrieved her from the woods. Dask, you are somewhat disoriented, having recently arrived back in your own senses from having dropped very briefly in on Vruta over in the confluence. And there is Apatia, much as you described her, hanging from the top of the window frame, greeting you in a way that you hope is a little more playful than ominous, but...
Yeah, can I roll Charm plus Jest to see how successfully I keep my cool, given the rather unusual nature of the situation?
I would like nothing more than for you to roll Charm plus Jest. Wonderful. That will be 5 dice. All
right. That is 2 sixes. Oh, I'm sorry, actually 2 nines.
All right. So... You may or may not be a stranger to having to think on your feet in the middle of the night when somebody just, you know, pops in and says a thing to you, whether that had been in the family home in Theret or in your quarters in the Confluence previously. So, you know, I think you can assume that you are as thinking as well on your feet as you ever do at 3 a.m.
All right. Yeah, then I probably say something not by any means clever, but serviceable, like it's truly a delicious evening. Would you like to come in?
Apatia smiles at you, showing teeth, which she doesn't always do when she smiles. Reminder to our listeners, Apatia's teeth are all at least a little bit sharp, and she just lets go of the window frame and somehow kind of like seems to just be falling, but ends up on her feet in a more or less standing position. She makes almost no noise, but she does say, again aloud, which has not always been the rule with her. She says, "Thank you for inviting me in." And seems content to just sort of slowly drift across the floor in your direction, having said that.
I guess on the strength of those two nines still, I say I'd offer you refreshment, but I think your tastes skew toward the definitive, and perhaps that would be forward.
She sort of cocks her head a little bit at you. And considers for a brief moment before she responds with forward, backward, it all goes in some direction except around you. And at you, she boops your nose.
Ghost miracle, her finger briefly visually disappears when it boops my nose.
Interesting.
You're like a dog that avoids boops.
This would be a terrible power for an actual dog to have.
It really would. This is going to be strange.
That was the idea.
But I am going to have you roll for me. Mm-hmm. Command plus dodge. It's going to be four dice. It's an unconventional pairing, okay, to be sure.
Rolling for mundane social interactions is Dask's lane. No matches.
Yes.
Okay. Her finger does not disappear. You feel your miracle happen and then just sort of fizzle to nothing in the influence of her Arcturitas, which is stronger than your own.
Team successful boop!
She certainly could have allowed it to function. There was no hostile intent or malice aforethought to the miracle, and that would have been clear. It'd have been hard to harm somebody, even a mortal, with a ghost miracle. But she just seems to have decided not to allow it to take. And her cool finger just boop. And then she brings it, the finger still extended, back toward her face and kind of gives it a little little sniff as though like it was a glass of wine, and then touches it to her tongue and smiles in a way that is hard to call beatific because of the sharp teeth, but seems very transcendent nonetheless. And she's sort of hovering right on the edge of your personal space, as it is, but she kind of murmurs as though not to be heard by you, but it is allowed. So says, "I wonder if we can keep him."
I opt not to. Do I ask for clarification? Where would I begin? I say, pardon?
She looks up at you somewhat perfunctorily and says, oh, of course, you are pardoned.
I put a pin in this. Is Ivy going to be all right?
Apacia looks over at Ivy laying in the bed and says, somewhat solemnly by her standards,
I wish I could be sure, but only time will tell. Even Mother Nyx gives me no insight here. I do not know why this is, but I have been working to find out. There is precious little information.
And on the phrase precious little, her eyes shift from Ivy back to lock eyes with you.
I'm familiar with that problem. Mott, perhaps you've probably heard of Mott, but the obsidian god, the others, the mortals, call them, and not very forthcoming. So Nyx asks, what of you exactly? What is it you do for these people and your mother?
At this point, the flow of conversation has probably gotten steady enough that basically two things are true. Apacia is clearly growing more confident and with greater facility in Taraxin the longer she talks to you in it. Her accent is still present. She speaks with odd inflections and seems to sort of do some things in a monotone where you would expect expression and do some things with exaggerated expression. But it's almost happening in real time. Two, Lyssa, you become aware of a conversation going on around you, and you rejoin the conscious in the room.
Am I aware of her rousing?
I think probably. Okay. It's a small and quiet enough room that someone the size of Lyssa moving even a little bit probably does, catch notice.
In that case, I add to my stream of gibberish then. Lyssa, we have a guest.
Toss back a cover. I imagine Lyssa doesn't sleep in a whole lot. Probably like the bare minimum just to make Toss comfortable. Mm-hmm. So probably like, underwear and a tank or whatever the equivalent of that would be.
Sure.
I toss small back the clothes. Covers and kind of look at a patient surprise and say, well, nighttime visits suit you, my lady of sensation.
Apacia, gives you one of her sort of tight-lipped smiles, not in the sense of, like, tense, but in the sense of not showing her teeth, and says to you, good morning, Lady of Fury. She turns back to Dask and says, what is... You said Mott? They are a god? Surely there is but Mother Nyx.
We've reason to believe there are a great many more, actually. Certainly more than is dreamt of in my philosophy, as it were. Yes, we've met Mott, and that seems to be the source of the things we can do, and Mother Nyx seems to be the source of the things you can do, and it seems that there are other beings that are unrelated, or perhaps related, but different. There's a great many of us, I think.
While you are talking, her eyes continually track back and forth from your face to a point in the air about 3 feet and like to one side, it seems like. And it takes you a moment to realize that when she's looking at your face, she's focusing on your mouth as you talk. And so her eyes keep tracking back from your mouth to this point in the air, not super rapidly, but, half a dozen times while you're talking. And she cocks her head to one side when you finish, and she sort of shakes it. She goes,
I will have to look into this because Nyx disagrees. I'm not sure on what grounds. She is as clear as she can be. We should travel to where she can be heard more clearly. Are you well enough for it?
Looking back and forth between Dusk and Lyssa.
I can't imagine that I could be any worse. And I think, in fact, it would be an improvement given the company.
Apatia glances at Dusk and then seems to go,
oh, yes, well, we should get a start then.
It's still between 3 and 4 a.m. but she begins to stride purposefully toward the door.
What about Ivy?
Oh, well, only time will tell if she'll be okay. I don't think it's a good use of our time to stay here and watch. We won't be able to do anything about it.
Is she going to turn into a bear again? We've brought her into the middle of the village.
Oh. That's not clear, I suppose. It hasn't happened before, but neither has anybody been brought back so quickly before.
She shrugs one shoulder and says, I'm not sure. Are you coming?
I look at Ivy and I look at Apatia and then kind of gather up my things and start throwing on some clothes.
My impulse was to leave a note with Ivy. Mm-hmm. Now, it would not be in my native tongue, so obviously I'll roll for that. But what I'd be trying to say was, we don't think she'll be a bear again, but she might become a bear again.
Point of order. I don't know that you've encountered much written Diamond.
Oh, that's true, yeah. Good point.
So really think you can leave a note in Diamond.
That's a good point.
Can we draw ask Apatia
pictures? Ask Apatia for help. Just, you know, hey, could you help us leave a note?
At the very least, let's hope that if morning comes and she has not transformed, but then a transformation is on the horizon, as it were, folks are not caught unawares.
Apatia nods. She says, that is most considerate of you.
And she produces from within one of her sleeves a white handkerchief that she lays on the night table. And then she holds up a fist and squeezes very hard until two drops of blood fall on the handkerchief and bleed out onto the handkerchief in the shape of letters. And she examines it for a moment and then nods. And then moves back toward the door.
I dare say we've done what we can. How are you? How is it? Are you as well as you could be, indeed? Or are you being tough?
Oh, I'm always tough.
Sure. But I mean, you know what I mean.
I'm managing, thank you.
All right.
So, having gotten your things together, you follow Apatia out into the hallway where she is standing inches from the door, directly in front of it, and sort of looking intently. She addresses Dusk and says, I almost forgot. And she sort of bows her head forward a little bit, maintaining eye contact, and says,
may I taste you?
Without thinking about it, I look to Lyssa to see if this is okay.
I shrug.
I match her shrug as best I can. It's obviously at a slightly different scale. And then I extend my arm in a gallant way. I probably throw my other arm back behind me.
Out of curiosity, which arm do you extend?
Is Dusk left-handed or right-handed? Left.
All right. Extend your left hand. Apatia smiles broadly with all of her teeth and then chomps down on your wrist. It hurts for a moment and you feel the blood well up and then it feels fine. And when she withdraws her mouth, there aren't any marks. There's no blood left on your skin, although there is some on her lips. And her eyes roll up into the back of her head, and she gives something that is sort of at the intersection of, like, a sigh and, like, a groan, and then catches herself on the wall and goes,
"That is why you are needed."
She kind of shakes her head and goes,
"Yes, that will do nicely."
And then starts walking toward the stairs.
I try not to look intensely jealous.
I don't. My appeal is narrower than yours, but it's not non-existent.
No. Apparently your blood tastes delicious. I'm not sure what to do with this information.
If it makes you feel any better, I do think there's a not remote possibility that this could cause me mortal danger, this fact that my blood is delicious. It makes me think that perhaps someone not too long from now may want all of it.
Oh, that is slightly alarming. I guess we'll staunch that wound when we get there.
Well said.
You hear the front door to the warehouse open and close.
If we plan to follow, we should probably do so.
I start walking briskly, but with the kind of gait of someone used to moderating their steps for shorter people. Yeah.
I look at my wrist like I touched a celebrity here, and I won't be washing it for
nothing
a while.
At all.
Most excellent. So, you catch up to Apacia, who is walking at a sort of dignified, stately pace. Her hands folded in front of her, back sort of ramrod straight, eyes sort of forward and up a little bit. As you catch up to her, she seems to be looking at kind of a lot of nothing. You can't really see much. In the sky is scattered clouds, so there's clouds and stars, but there's not like bats or birds or anything just yet. But she seems to be sort of like glancing around at different things in the sky as you catch up to her. She's walking, basically continuing your route that you were taking around the central lake in the Vale here over to the canyon city on the other side.
I catch up with her in a few longer strides, so I'm right beside her, and I see her gazing at nothing and politely clear my throat before asking, if I may ask, my radiant friend, did you choose to work for Nyx?
She smiles without looking directly at you. She continues to kind of flit her gaze between unidentifiable things she must be looking at in the sky. It could be clouds or stars, but and she says,
no, I was chosen by Mother Nyx. I was, well, she has not said so, but I like to think that I was created by Mother Nyx for this purpose. She has difficulty communicating in a way that humans can understand. And so I am her intermediary, able to speak both to people and, well, Mother Nyx hears all, but I can hear her more clearly than most.
And do you enjoy working for Mother Nyx?
Oh, yes, very much. She has so much to share with her children, but for the longest time had no way to let them know. It is an honor and a privilege to help and bring about the way she always meant for us to live.
And how does she mean for us to live?
She gestures broadly at the valley and she says, largely like this. There are still some areas for improvement, and
unfortunates like Ivy still pop up from time to time, but this peace, this...
She seems to be grasping for a word. She says a couple in Diamok before she says in Taraxin,
neighborliness did not always exist in this valley, but in my short years here, I have helped Nyx to bring it closer to her vision for her children.
It's really lovely here.
She turns and looks at you for the first time in the conversation and smiles, and she says,
I am glad you find it so. I was worried. There is so much...
licks her lips.
Turbulence. That I wasn't sure you would see the value in Nyx's path. But I am glad that you do. It is my life's work, and will continue to be.
I kind of nod and smile and pointedly not reference anything about turbulence.
So, Apatia and Lyssa sort of let the conversation trail off for a moment. Dusk is catching up. And around the time that he does catch up, Apatia turns and looks at Dusk first and then over at Lyssa and addresses the question to Lyssa of, did you choose to serve this Mott then?
No. I did not choose sort of.
I am possibly slightly out of breath from catching up with the two of them, and I go, no! No.
Her eyebrows sort of creep up a little bit, and she says,
perhaps it is not the sort of thing one chooses, then. I shall be interested to learn more about it.
She seems at that point to be talking mostly to herself, and then falls silent again.
I whisper to Lyssa, was she talking to me?
I couldn't hear a word of that because of it got dropped from Discord. So let's do that again.
The whispering was something too
close. Whispering is more than
Discord can handle. I whisper to Lyssa, the wittiest thing anyone has ever heard on a podcast.
It's a joke that would surely be fatal.
Yes, exactly. We've edited it out for your protection, dear listener. There's actually an edit here because we all spent a week in the hospital after the cleverness of that quip. So I said to Lyssa quietly, but perhaps not in a whisper, in a stage whisper. Was she talking about Nyx? Do we know anything? Do we know what's happening? Does she want all of my blood?
I don't have a good answer to any of that. She seems nice enough. I'm kind of give Dusk a smile, and my eyes crease with it, but it doesn't quite wholly reach my eyes.
I probably don't notice that. I'm probably hearing and seeing what I want to see and hear. And that's painful for me, a human, playing as this character.
So sorry.
This Apatia is tearing us apart.
No, not
yet anyway. But not something one chooses. So she didn't choose to be in the service of a deity either then.
But Mother Nyx seems a lot more reasonable than Mott. She actually enjoys serving Nyx, and part of Nyx's work has been everything we've seen so far.
Interesting. Can one change allegiances, do you think? It's too early for that. Who knows?
Yeah. It's like you took the thought out of my head.
At about that time, you realize that mere moments before, Apatia has stopped by the side of the road very suddenly. She sort of stopped walking and then turned, looking just the uphill side of the road. You've been walking after you exited the town through sort of the periphery of the forest with what is mostly pasture land between your road and the shore of the lake, well downhill from you. but carved out of the, you know, loose tree cover of the forest's edge near the road, just uphill, is, well, you're reminded very briefly, Dusk in particular, of some of the parks in the nicer parts of Ferret, where there are little patches of green with a big monument or a statue in them. In this case, what you have is a carved wooden likeness of a part animal, part person. It's very weathered, so it's hard to tell specific characteristics. They are armed and armored, and have what appear to be furry clawed legs, and they're sort of in a battle position. The whole likeness is maybe 10, 12 feet tall and set on a stone, pedestal, probably sounds a little too dainty, stone slab that has some etching in the writing that you glimpsed in Apacia's extremely melodramatic note leaving, on that handkerchief that she had produced. It isn't a lot of writing, but it seems to commemorate, well, someone, perhaps an event. And Apacia has stopped and is staring at it, looking, it probably wouldn't be an overstatement to say, forlorn.
Does this represent people like Ivy?
Apacia sighs. I think there might be a link, but no. These were not people who turned into animals in any literal sense. These were people who were animalistic in their ferocity. They are given animal features in effigy to commemorate them. I hope one day that they shall all be pulled down, maybe refashioned. It was not a good time.
She kind of closes her eyes, seemingly in prayer, and then just kind of shakes her head briefly and says,
my apologies. We should continue, but I always like to take the opportunity to be reminded.
And she sort of turns, not sharply, but quickly, and starts walking again down the path.
Before she gets too far, I'm going to approach the image and lay my hand onto the rock. Do a lesser creation of fury to see if I can get the rock to fall apart, or at least erase the image, thinking that it's been forced to choose to take a form that it did not choose for itself.
Okay. You place your hand on the rock, and you feel immediate relief from the pain of having your estate under attack. This is not a rock that it's, you know, tutelary spirits are angry at anything, but there is nevertheless some, it has been imbued with some kind of fury. It doesn't pulse or radiate or grow. It's more like the memory of fury resides in this stone and in this statue.
Are there any loose portions of it that I could just pocket? Or anything I could coerce to come loose with me. I have already changed my mind about destroying the image because I don't want to necessarily knock myself out here now.
Right. Let's see. Why don't you give me a body plus vigor roll. That's going to be 4 dice.
Two fours.
Where your hand touches sort of the corner of the slab, going from the facing side to the top where the carved statue rests, the sensation is such a surprise. You just, and you crush a little piece off into your hand. And it doesn't crumble. And it doesn't flare. It just stays solid, reassuring, feeling heavy and not literally warm, but sort of spiritually warm in your hands. Maybe about the size of like a whetstone, you know, clutched in one hand. And you can't see that anything has changed either in your mundane or your mythic sight. Maybe it's just in your perception, but you could swear that there is a sense of satisfaction from the monument.
Does a little rock help my headache?
It would be wrong to say that it relieves it, but it gives you some grounding. It gives you kind of, you know, if the headache is a maelstrom in the sea, the rock is a piece of driftwood you can cling to.
Excellent. I move on quickly.
You catch back up. Yeah. You catch back up with Apacia. And she's content to walk in silence for some time. Though, if you wish to start any particular conversation with her, that probably will be fine. She has yet to rebuff any particular remarks.
I feel like I've been asking a lot of questions, so I ask her if there's anything she'd like to know about Dosk or myself.
She asks for time to think on it, and about the time the sun is coming up, so you've been walking for a little over an hour, including your pause at the monument by this point, and it's, I mean, just breathtakingly beautiful. The sun is coming up kind of not squarely at your backs, but mostly behind you, and just sort of throws this shortening shadow. You can see the light kind of sweeping towards you across the valley, sparkling off the water and popping the colors in the forest, and you can hear it coming alive around you. The road you've been on has passed a few homesteads, but you haven't quite gotten to the next major village on this particular thoroughfare. And right around that time, she breaks her, again, like half hour or so of considering silence, and says, to borrow a phrase from Dosk, she says, looking over at him, this could be forward, backward, forward. Would you consider staying here in the valley?
When you say staying, do you mean for a while or forever?
She seems confused by the question at first, and she says,
well, I suppose we may be quite long-lived now that you mention it, so for potentially as long as was necessary.
She sounds less certain than you've heard her sound before. But she says,
I think possibly both of you, and certainly Dosk, could be of great help to Mother Nix and to myself, to the people of this valley. Your unique properties are, in some ways, exactly what we've been looking for.
I say yes, like it's been building, and start to ramble on about the forges and the techniques that I've seen here, and the fact that I would have to bring someone with me, that I don't really have a place to go back to aside from a place that doesn't really have a sun, and it's kind of dreary, and I can't find anything bright to decorate it with. or socks.
By the time you... By the time you finish with this, you can observe that Apacia has this really sort of warm smile on, and she sort of takes your near hand in both of hers, pausing in her stride, and says,
We shall, of course, have to consult with Mother Nyx, but I believe that with your help, we can truly make this place into a paradise.
And she turns and looks at Dusk and says,
and especially with yours. I cannot,
and her eyelids sort of flutter a little bit as she looks at you. She says,
I cannot describe how necessary I think you are to Diamach and to Mother Nyx.
Pauses, looks at Lyssa, looks at Dusk and says,
and perhaps to others,
and then starts walking again.
We're something of a packaged deal, but yes, I think we'll consider that she's not listening. All right, well, this seems promising in regards to switching allegiances.
It does, but I know better than to get my hopes up.
Yeah, yeah. I imagine we're in sullen silence for a short time after that.
I just twirl the rock in my hand and kind of toss it a few times like I'm feeling the weight of it in my palm.
You carry on for a little while, lagging just a little bit behind Apatia. And almost like something coming into sight over the horizon, although it's not on the road so you can't actually see it. Lyssa, you sense a small-scale fury. Just a human anger moving sort of in the opposite direction to you along the hillside, but up in the forest. It's actually the first time you felt such a thing since you arrived on these shores.
I probably track it with my head, but I probably... Actually, I need to use the restroom. I'm afraid that I had too much to drink. It just you know, you think my bladder would be larger than it is, but it's not.
So Lyssa then heads up into the trees, I take it.
Yeah. If I could have a little bit of privacy, like, you know, I did that this is one area where I draw a line.
All right. You head up into the trees. The presence of this fury is further up the hill from you and moving slowly to the generally easterly direction in a counterclockwise circuit of the lake. You guys are, or sorry, in the clockwise circuit of the lake, you guys are taking a counterclockwise one.
Are they within shouting distance or am I going to have to kind of move to catch up to them?
They might be in shouting distance, but if you shout, it will certainly be heard from the road as well.
I'm just going to catch up with them with my long legs.
Okay. Sorry, just the way you phrased that, it did sort of sound like you had other alternate shorter legs.
You know, I carry those in my pack just in case. Sure.
Yeah. That's a Draga thing. That's on YouTube. That's not this podcast. That's Legzy. That's a whole other character.
They're good for sprinting. What can I say?
Yeah. So that's going to be just rolling three dice for body since you don't have any points in run.
No matches, but this seems important. So Lady Luck takes pity on my headache, and I'm going to reroll. Still no matches. I don't think Lady Luck has ever smiled upon me on that second roll.
She resents being invited.
So you...
She's like, this girl is still hitting on me.
Always interrupting her spa day to re-roll. Just comes Nobody with cucumbers on her eyes and a mud mask on her face.
Nobody ever thinks about Lady Luck's schedule, you know?
No one ever thinks about Lady Luck's luck.
She was in a very important meeting. That would be ironic. Lady Luck only ever gets summoned when she's in the middle of something important. So, you take off in the direction of this fury, and you guess they must have heard you because they start sprinting away from you.
I'm going to do a ghost miracle.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, kind of let them feel the solidarity of my rage.
Okay.
Maybe let forth a whispered, hey, I just want to talk.
Right. I do want to point out you have not actually laid eyes on them.
Yeah.
Just so that our listener is imagining this correctly. For your miracle having the effect you want it to have, let's roll charm plus graces 5 dice.
Two eights.
The fury you were feeling, suddenly you catch the tail end of it being snuffed out by fear, and then you've lost track of them entirely.
Damn. I head back to the road, make a big show of hitching my pants back up.
Not for the first or the last time.
That was like a race. I had to be like a racehorse. Are there racehorses in Taraxis?
So in Taraxis, yes. Okay. You haven't seen a horse here.
Alright, it's probably a colloquialism that a patient will be confused by, but Dosk may appreciate it.
Apatia does not seem to spend much time dwelling on it, but simply nods and continues on. It's not long after that that you pass through sort of the next town. It's very similar to the one you just came from. You could tell the difference between the two of them on a postcard, but it's a matter of geography and size, the, you know, types of structures and general, you know, kind of vibe of the town seems very similar. People who come out to see the visitors see Apatia and immediately bow their heads, or maybe even just bow and sort of stay quiet until you've passed. And pretty much that's the way the day goes. You walk with Apatia at a steady but relatively undemanding pace, keeping to the path, the woods uphill to your right, the lake downhill to your left, as the sun sort of moves overhead and then to, roughly speaking, in front of you. And you pass through probably a total of 4 of these villages. You lose count of the number of homesteads that you can see from the road as you pass by. You also pass by 2 more of those monuments. One of them so old that it is pretty much just kindling, and the etching is worn, and one of them seeming maybe only a couple of decades old. But certainly the newest one you've seen. That one has somebody with cat-like legs and hands. And you can see their features. They're clearly Diamach features, but the woman it depicts has, you know, sort of much shorter, more practical hair than is common among male or female Diamachor that you've seen so far. And a sort of, not an animalistic snarl, but sort of like a superior sneer on her face in the carving.
Oh, and I don't think Apatia is paying attention. I kind of go rawr in the direction. I make sure Dosk is looking and then kind of smile and wink at him.
At each of these, Apatia does sort of stop and hold a little vigil. They seem to sadden her. But when night begins to fall, you are between villages on the road, and Apatia shows no sign of slowing down. She just keeps walking.
Are you good, Dosk? You didn't get any sleep? I can always carry you for a while if you want to get some shut-eye.
That's not the most dignified, but I may need to take you up on it at some point if we're to continue. Do we know how much farther this is?
We could ask.
Well, you can also, when you have an open view, see. Mm. You have probably gone between a third and a half of the way around that route, probably let's call it closer to a half from where you started, the pass that you came in from to the city. From your stop at the village that you were staying in. You've covered ground at a pretty decent pace. The road, while not highly engineered or very wide, is very comfortable walking. And kept clear of undue, wear and tear. It's not heavily rutted or anything. So it's been pretty easy going. You haven't been hurrying, but you've been making steady time, and you walked from 4 a.m. until, it was probably like 7 p.m.-ish at this point.
The third option, would be explaining the notion of sleep to our guide. If we're to live here permanently, that may be necessary.
Oh, yeah, that's definitely a conversation we're going to have eventually. But for the record, I have been told that my shoulder is very comfortable, as is like this sort of upper arm portion of my chest.
Wouldn't want you to think me ungrateful. I take her up on the carrying offer.
I'll let you decide front or back, Dosk.
I was going to say I pictured a full like baby Bjorn situation.
I think that's what Lissa's hoping for, but she also understands that may be a little bit emasculating.
Just literally infantilizing.
Right. Boy, this just became a whole different podcast. So I, perhaps not having these words for it, but feeling some of these feelings, I think I hop on Lissa's back.
All right. You hop on Lissa's back, and you doze for a time as Lissa carries you, seemingly without too much effort. A patient does at one point look back and see you doing this and pauses and waits for you to catch up. She's not terribly far ahead of you at this point. But she murmurs to Lissa. She says,
"Is Dosk well?"
He's just tired. He didn't get any sleep last night. We've been walking for a day. We still are at a point, I don't know if this is true for everyone like us, but we still need sleep. Sleep is nice.
Apatia sort of puts her hand on her head. She says, "Oh my, I am terribly sorry. I should have thought of that. Really, I should have. It's been something I've had to get used to my whole life. I've never needed to sleep. But I am aware that others do. I just forgot. But I think I may have an alternative." And she starts to reach her hand out, and she takes it back. She says, "May I?"
"Oh, of course. I think I can do something similar. So I'd be curious to experience what I think you're going to do." And I hold my hand
out. She smiles and she says, "I'm told it's relatively pleasant, but those were normal humans, so hopefully it holds true for nothing and Fury as well." And she ignores your hand and touches two fingers to your forehead. And you feel it's an anachronistic analogy, but you feel like you have experienced all of the lighting of an entire rave in like a split second. And at first it's kind of unpleasant because your body just like surges with adrenaline, but then it stabilizes and you just have this sort of giddy sensation, this wakeful feeling, and your limbs feel less leaden, your eyes feel less scratchy. It's not really that you feel rested, it's just that you aren't feeling the effects of being tired.
A patient is better than coffee. I beam at a patient and say, "Thank you. I can do something similar if you'd like to see."
She cocks her head to one side. She says, "There may well be a time for such experimentation. It should certainly be done under Nyx's eye, though." And glances at your destination across the lake. She gestures then at Dosk, where he's sort of on Lyssa's shoulder.
Yeah.
And asks Lyssa, will he mind?
Let's make sure we get consent from him first. And I kind of jostle him, like kind of do a little bounce.
You're not the crazy one, Verta. I am the crazy one. What? good morning.
Apatia smiles at you and says, not quite morning. No, I merely was wondering if it was all right with you if I attempted to wash away, submerge, translate your fatigue.
Translate? Wash away? Sure? Yeah. Sure. Yes.
She places two fingers against your forehead, and you experience a bewildering cascade of colors for a moment. Your body dumps adrenaline into your system, and then the feeling mellows out. You feel pretty refreshed. Not well rested per se, but certainly not feeling the ill effects of being ill rested.
I assume I either fall off of Lyssa's back or I'm gripping her kind of hard when this moment is over. But
probably the second okay. one, I'm guessing.
That's bracing. Thank you. All right, I think I can walk, run, sprint now, if need be. Walk is probably better. Would you mind putting me down?
I do like a nice little squat and set him gently back down on the ground.
Yeah, you have your feet back under you and you continue your journey. It gets quite dark, as it is wont to do at night. But the sky is quite beautiful. The clouds have mostly cleared from the beginning of your journey this morning. And you can see the stars bright in the clear sky overhead, the silhouettes of the mountain peaks, and a few of the lights burning in the city on the other side of the lake. Although it's coming to be the city on your side of the lake as you continue forward. You stop twice more at these monuments by the roadside. You pass through a sleeping village and by a number of homesteads. And by the time the sun is getting ready to rise again, you can see people at the homesteads coming out to chop wood and feed chickens and things like that. As you round the sort of final approach to the city, you think at first that you're coming to another village, but what you're really coming to is sort of the place where villages sort of run into one another around the entrance to this canyon where the city is. And that's probably around mid-morning. As you pass, of course, activity stills and people show respect for Apatia. So it's probably around midday when you find yourself at the gates to the city. As Apatia approaches, the gates open and the entire complement of guards, not armored, only carrying billy clubs, but wearing a uniform of pretty snazzy design, they file out in two lines and sort of bow as she passes, and you pass under the gate, and Apatia gestures to this city. This canyon is quite wide, but the sides are very sheer, and the whole thing, even here at midday, is shrouded and shadowed. There's no direct light anywhere. In fact, looking up at the narrow strip of sky you can see above you, there's faint stars visible in the sky. And Apatia turns to face you with a wide grin on her face, the most sort of childlike, enthusiastic expression you've seen on her face, and making a grandiose gesture from the sky out to the walls of the canyon, says,
welcome to Kilada, the city of Mother Nyx.
And what a city it is. All of the construction is cut stone. No mortar to be found anywhere. It's fitted very tightly. There are slate shingles on the roofs. And many of the buildings, as you look over toward where the canyon walls rise sharply from the ground, are cut or hewn into the walls of the canyon with sort of switchbacking, ramped walkways and roads cutting up the sides, almost to the very lip of the canyon, many, many feet above you. Down the center of the canyon runs something that could be classified as a river in some places and a stream in others, with myriad stone bridges crossing over it. And there are crowds of people, men and women and children, seemingly all fairly well-dressed and fairly happy. Despite the lack of direct sunlight here in the canyon, it seems that they must get out fairly often because there's none of the pallor of Fermata anywhere among Diamacor living in this canyon. They tend toward fair in hair and complexion, but very few of them here seem, you know, pale or pallid. And there is a lot of industriousness as you walk the first couple of hundred feet into the city. You can see craftsmen, artisans working and plying their crafts, selling their wares almost anywhere that you look. It would appear that dwellings are further away from the center of the canyon, and various kinds of places of occupation and business are closer to the center. The canyon goes back more or less straight ahead for quite some distance, and just sort of on the edge of your ability to sort of perceive this level of detail at the other end of the canyon seems to be sort of the back of this odd cityscape, where a whole sheer rock face has been carved into one monumental building. It's so different from the relatively rustic abodes that you've seen elsewhere in the valley, and yet you can see some continuity here all the same. The quality of the craftsmanship, the, you know, sort of orderly aesthetic unity, and the relative industriousness all seem continuous throughout the valley from what you've seen. So yeah, here you are.
I'd probably linger at some of the craftsman stalls as long as I feel is appropriate, kind of like a child that has just seen a toy store but is cognizant that their mom is walking on ahead and that they're going to get scolded if they pause too long.
You're glad that you do this, though, because you had seen what many of the various crafts and wares in the villages were, you know, all of that really fine precious metal and stone craft, you know, a lot of sort of hardwood creations, some of unknown provenance, leather works and furs. Here, though, there's an entirely different caliber of industry. You can actually see there's a fairly booming business near the gate, especially in what seem to be odd and intricate musical instruments. Taraxis tends toward relatively simple pipe and flute wind instruments with more complex stringed and percussion instruments. These are extremely elaborate wind instruments, made in some cases entirely of metal, with many fine moving parts. You also see, probably not for the very first time, stained glass, but it is rare in Taraxis, and certainly nothing this fine. You see even just some that are clearly intended as like decorations, not even installments of windows. You see many things advertising medicines of types that are unfamiliar to you entirely. as well as things that seem like they'd be medicine, but don't seem to be advertised or hawked that way. It's more for like, try chewing this for a good time. But by far the most interesting and unusual thing you behold is what you take at first for just an intricate sculpture of wood and metal, until you see that parts of it are moving. It has all of these little interlocking metal pieces, and it takes you a moment to see that there's a spring providing tension for movement, and one piece moves another until, after a certain interval, a little sound and figure move and then return to their resting places. You've seen nothing like it before. The degree of fine craftsmanship required is difficult to conceive of. You don't even know if you would have the tools to do something like this, even if you had the know-how. Apatia, for her part, is sort of playing the indulgent parent, you know, as you travel through sort of the main thoroughfare here towards the back of this canyon. She offers very little in the way of explanation, but, you know, waits anytime you wish to stop and, you know, is all smiles when you return.
This is incredible.
I take a mental inventory of everything that that would win me a rapturous conversation with Uncle Melly, and also just everything I want or want to understand. Chief among them, I wouldn't have the word mechanical even, but that stuff. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The cuckoo clock.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. The closest thing that you can think to put it in a category with is cargo machinery. Mm-hmm. In harbors, in Taraxis. It's metal and tiny rather than wooden and large, but that's the only place you've really seen this kind of mechanism. For Lyssa, it would remind you probably most of a mill. For what it's worth, Dosk, almost anything you have seen in Kilata would be something that Uncle Melly would be extremely interested in. And having at least one of for posterity, study, prestige, sale.
Yeah, what I probably say out loud is, we may need to stay here, because if I try to take an inventory, I mean, my family will just want to buy the town. And that wouldn't go well, I don't think, for the people here.
I'm inclined to agree. We don't want greedy people coming here for their own devices.
You're right. It'd be a waste, for one thing, because these things are not even meant to buy and sell. They're meant simply to wonder at. This machine that it machines time itself. It's incredible. I'm having a difficult time. You as well?
I just want to learn. I want to find the nearest forge and some lovely company to teach me how to tool these things.
I agree. I just want to. I feel a feast set before me, and I know that I can't eat it all in one sitting, but I know that I'm going to try anyway.
I have the same hunger.
As you continue, Apatia continues to lead you back into the town, and as you get further in, there is less activity, and you start to see people dressed not exactly like Apatia is, but using the same fabric that her outfit is made of in places, with this deep, deep blue and these silvery pinpricks all over. And you realize that the building, the edifice that you saw carved into the rock at the back of the canyon, is in fact a temple. And as you come to the plaza before it, it is stunning. First, there's a statue that was not easy to see from the sort of downhill further out portions of the city because of, well, the canyon isn't perfectly straight. It is apparently made entirely of the living rock. Like, it's not resting on the ground. It is carved from the rock that comprises the ground. And it appears to be a conceptual rendering of Apatia. It doesn't look like her, but it sort of has all of her features, although the mouth is closed, so you can't see the sharpened teeth that are presumably there. It's sort of as like maybe Apatia is an instance of the archetype this statue represents, the big difference being that this statue has large bat-like wings extending on either side from it. Its gaze is turned upward and fixed directly on where the moon is visible in the sky now that it is fully afternoon. Behind that statue and beyond the plaza, carved into the rock at the back of this canyon, is a temple that seems made mostly of windows with balconies around them. Again, not made of multiple pieces, all just carved that way. They should seem chaotic and haphazard, given that they are not levelly spaced in orderly straight lines, that they're not the same sizes in height nor width nor depth. Given that some are lit and some are not, yet there's a certain harmony to it. The longer you look at it, the more it makes you think of how no two stars in the sky are exactly the same size or brightness or follow the same path through the sky, but taken all together, they are nevertheless beautiful. At the foot of the statue, I should say behind the foot of the statue, the spring that serves as the source for the river slash stream that runs out of the canyon burbles up. It splits around the statue and then reunifies on the other side and flows out down the canyon. It appears that the wall that the temple is carved into was not the original back of the canyon. This stream, in order for this canyon to form, would have flowed out from the rock underground, and much of the back of this canyon was hewn out at some point to sort of continue it backward and free up these headwaters so that this statue could be placed here. Apatia seems to be watching for reactions, by the way.
I probably am just staring agape at all of the splendor and for months and beyond words. if it's a good thing there's not an abundance of flies around because they would have all ended up in Lissa's mouth.
A few would have been saved from that fate because they would have gone into dusks as well. I stammer, this is more than I dared expect. All of it.
Apatia smiles and says, as though this is what she was expecting, Mother Nyx always is.
This is truly beautiful. I've never seen anything like this in my wildest dreams. And believe me, I've had some pretty wild dreams.
This may sound strange, but I can confirm that.
Apatia, displaying the first hint of this kind of self-awareness you've seen from her, says, I suppose none of us really have a leg to stand on in order to talk about strangeness. But, as promised, I can hear Mother Nyx more strongly here. And she would like me to explain to you what it is that we hope you can help us with. Where before I was unsure where to start, she has given me the words.
I think in order to do it justice, though, she looks at Dosk, she says, what you did in the common room of the Wayhouse, where you, her brow furrows, where you became, can you do it again?
I can. All right, I'm going to. I do a lot of unnecessary wind-up.
You've got this.
Fair enough.
some shuffle feet, some various pugilistic gestures, and I spread my arms grandly, and I assume the aspect of nothing.
Almost as soon as you assume the aspect of nothing, Apatia... Well, she throws herself at you in a hug like you have seen the families of sailors and captains who have been gone on long voyages give to them when they return. And squeezing you in her arms, she shudders and sighs as though she has just put down a very heavy burden. And then sort of twisting, keeping both arms sort of around your middle, but sort of rotating to face toward Alyssa with one of her shoulders kind of by you and her arms kind of wrapped around Dosk to her left. She begins.
Mother Nyx's design for Diamok has always been peace, prosperity, neighborliness. But she was unable to communicate with most of them for so long that they strayed far. Upon my birth, Mother Nyx was able to institute, well, we call it here the Law of Serenity. Where before there was violence and revenge and feuding, we now have tranquility. She looks up at Dosk in a way that Dosk makes your heart kind of beat pretty hard in your chest and says, I see the world as Mother Nyx does. It has taken me long to be able to put it into words, and I'm not sure I will ever understand it, but most people experience a thing with one, two senses at a time. See it and smell it and taste it and feel it. I experience everything with all of the senses available to one of our kind at all times. And so it has been difficult for me to achieve the serenity necessary to bring about Nyx's peace in this area. But she squeezes Dosk a little harder, and she says, but you are sweet relief. I can think more clearly. I can focus more narrowly. It is... You see a tear leak from the corner of one of her eyes, and she says, I never knew anything could be so peaceful. And she looks up at you earnestly, Dosk, and she says, I implore you to share this peace with the people of Diamok. With you here. And she looks at Lyssa. And with your power over fury and turbulence, your ability to, well, put it away with a thought, we could make this place exactly what Mother Nyx always envisioned for it so quickly, much more so than I could by myself. Mother Nyx invites you to stay. Please.
She rests her head gently on Dosk's shoulder.
Please say you'll stay.
What is this law of serenity that you spoke of?
She says, I know not what it's like where you have come from, but before my birth here, Tiamach was not the name of a people. It was the name of a region of many peoples. They lived, the villages, the homesteads, were kin groups. So-and-so married so-and-so and brought their sheep and their cattle and their goats and their sword arms into the fold. The sword arms were important because the livestock in particular were valuable to their neighbors. When the neighbors came raiding, if they killed someone, well, it was time to seek revenge. And so, back and forth and around, the feuding went for generations. Fortifications were built, weapons were forged, lives were taken. Those who were, and her voice becomes embittered and venomous here as she regards the ground as she speaks. Those who were most effective at avenging their fallen kin were given memorials in the vicinity of their homes, depicting them as so ferocious that they took on animal aspects according to their talents. Blasphemy. This was not what Mother Nix wanted for her children, but she had no way of making it known to them. She is too great, too wide, to be fully understood by human minds who have not been prepared for it. And so, at long last, she created me. I can hear her. She speaks through everything, all the time. I can interpret her will and relay it to the people of Tiamach. And so, over time, first, the Law of Serenity made peace between feuding clans, slowly at first. When I was 5 and 6 years old, I was able to use my miracles to broker some small peace here and there, and over time momentum built, until there were no feuds. And then, and she smiles broadly, looking alternately at Dusk and Lyssa, there had been no feuding for long enough that only a short time ago we were able to hold the summit of the villages in the valley and declare once and for all the disavowal of those ancestors who had committed the violence. The memorials would not be maintained. The ancestors would not be worshipped. The feuds would be repudiated. It was such a relief. I could feel Nix's joy. I can still feel Nix's joy resounding around the valley. That's the Law of Serenity. That one should strive not to wrong another. That the prosperity of one is good for the prosperity of all. And that grudges destroy those who hold them, as well as those they target. It is enforced, sometimes, rarely, with violence. But mostly people are glad to be free of the burden of their revenge. But we could spread the Law of Serenity beyond the valley. We could entrench it into the hearts and minds of the people here. With your talents, there would be nothing we couldn't do to ensure the eternal peace of the valley of the Diamacor and the will of Nix. Please. Please help me.
I don't know if it's going to be a lesser divination or a major one, but I would like to see if I can pinpoint the exact source here, because I imagine it's close, of the wound that seems to be in all the people of the valley.
Let's see. That's probably going to be a major divination because of the specificity of the information you're asking for, like the depth of understanding. Mm-hmm.
Fine by me.
Yeah. So you open yourself to your estate and you seek the source, the best way you can describe it, if asked, which I suppose nobody is if you are examining a wound and you're looking for the deepest injury, it's in the spot where you're standing. And the metaphorical place where the blade touched bone is currently clinging to Dusk.
I look at Apacia and say, it is quite a beautiful home and a noble goal to remove vengeance and violence. But tell me, my radiant friend, why does it feel like all of these people have a wound within them?
She looks extremely confused. She says, a wound? No, we have had far fewer wounds. There are almost no incidents of violence beyond children scuffling. Rare and few and far between are they.
You misunderstand me. I'm not talking about a physical wound on their mortal forms. I am talking about the fact that they cannot seem to feel fury or anything like that.
Blinks once and cocks her head, slowly loosening her grip on Dusk and sort of letting her arms fall to her side. And she says, I do not know. I do not know what you mean. And then she sort of stands up very straight and looks directly ahead of her, nodding once, pausing, nodding again, and then sort of slumping her shoulders a little and looking at the ground in front of her and saying, I think that what you perceive sometimes our doctors discover on a person an unnatural growth, something harming and feeding off the rest of the body. And if they are very lucky, if they get to it quickly and they are skilled, they can cut it out of the body, saving the life of the person to whom it was affixed. Though they will always have a scar to remind them of its presence there.
At this point,
perhaps what you are perceiving are the stitches.
At this point, it would be clear that while Dusk has not been speaking, he's been softly crying the entire time. He is not even slightly convinced that people cannot tell this about him. And as he's wiping his face, he says, I say, and what happens if the growth is not removed?
She looks at you, thinks for a moment, and says, in the case of a literal growth on a literal body, well, the person sickens over time, sometimes a long time, and one day they die. But the metaphor is limited. In this case, the death is not one final, lingering death. Her voice and her eyes grow hard as she continues. The death is many painful, tragic deaths in anger and fear and violence, inflicted by cold steel and colder hearts over years and years.
Violence is something I struggle with. But there are times I've found when fury has its benefits, and there are types of fury that should be allowed to persist And rage is the right of the oppressed. And what you've done here is oppress their feelings.
Apicia seems to genuinely not understand what you're saying. She seems confused. And on the phrase, oppress their feelings, her eyes dart to your wrist and then to your neck. And she says, I think I understand more now about our natures. I must. And she sits heavily, suddenly, directly on the pavement of the plaza. And she finishes the sentence softly. I must speak to Mother Nix. And she sort of crosses her legs underneath her and closes her eyes.
I watch her.
I do the same.
And in fact, I don't just watch her. All this talk of more senses than mortal beings have, I don't just watch her with my eyes and I don't just listen with my ears. I try to see what's going on with everything I've got. And if I can divine in some way an interruption in the nothing around me, if there's any way to sound, I try that too. I'm desperate to understand.
Okay. Let's see. Lissa, for the better part of an hour, you regard Apicia seated nearly motionless, breathing shallowly, hands folded in her lap, legs crossed underneath her habit, in the relatively sparsely used and populated plaza next to the statue here, hearing the headwaters of this stream burble around the statue. And you watch and you consider. Dusk, you strain. You open your senses. You use your divine senses. You consult with your estate. You try to perceive just about anything. And after the initial effort fades into the background, and you just sort of settle into a state of being, you think you're actually able to perceive, if not Nix, then her presence. There is something more than air around Apicia, getting more diffuse as it spreads out, but never down to zero here in this area in the Plaza of Quilada. And almost as soon as you perceive it, you feel that it concentrates around you. This doesn't bring with it any particular sensation, but you're unable to tell if it's merely interest or if it's an attempt to communicate, but you seem to have Nix's attention.
What have you done here? I probably say it in words, but I say it in other ways too. there's nothing in my human form that can project a scent with intention, or cause myself to glow like a sea creature, right, as a form of communication. But somehow I feel that I'm doing all of that.
I look indignant when I hear him say that out loud.
I am probably totally unaware, at least for the moment.
In a flash, Your divine senses can perceive the spiritual presence of Nyx as a discrete entity. It is not as simple as seeing a form in front of you, because as you have some experience with Mott, Nyx is the primordial stuff of the universe, imbued with individuality and personality. It's not very similar to a human at all. But suddenly your senses are able to perceive this particular entity. However, you don't seem well able to communicate with Nyx. And as the existential iridescence that is this presence in your spirit sight seems to try to bridge the gap between your perceptions and her own, a somewhat familiar sounding roar, this time with a distinctly feline cast, echoes through the canyon. And that's where we'll end our session for today. So, that concludes this session of Dice Punks. Thanks for joining us. I hope our players and listeners enjoyed it as much as I did, and that you'll all join us again next time. If you're hearing us now, then you probably know where to listen to this, but we can be found almost any place one can listen to podcasts, as well as on the wider web at dicepunks.com and on Twitter as @dicepunks. With that, I think we're ready to say farewell. Say goodbye to the fine, kind folks at home, players.
Thanks for listening, everybody. And remember, the intent of an embrace is everything.
Thanks for listening, everyone. And remember to feel, don't conceal. Frozen got it wrong.
Also, intent only matters with consent. That's important to clarify. That's important. Whether or not Dask would understand that. You're right. Frozen got it wrong.
And as the poet once said, in this sinless city, we wear calluses on our hands.
Thank you, dear listeners, for tuning in, and stick around through the admin stuff. There's a hilarious Dask fact waiting for you at the end of it. The songs in this episode, Theme of the Dice Punks and its acoustic version, were written and recorded by the Regal of Nothing himself, Drew. Cover art is by Joanne, illustrious spook mistress of our recent Halloween one-shot. Site design and graphics for DicePunks.com are by Robin, the player behind Lyssa, the irrepressible Duchess of Fury. Rain and the One Roll engine it runs on were created by Greg Stolze, whose work can be found in, well, a frankly astonishing number of cool places, but I'll point you toward GregStolze.com. Nobilis was created by Jenna Catherine Moran and can be found alongside much of her other really intriguing work both in and outside of tabletop roleplaying at afarandsunlessland.wordpress.com. Links to both systems and authors can be found on the Punk Grimoire section of our website, dicepunks.com. Thank you so much for listening. If you liked what you heard, well, that's reward enough on its own, really, but if you're so inclined, you can help us out by rating and reviewing us wherever you listen to us, telling your friends who you think would like us to give us a listen, and even by heading over to our Patreon at patreon.com/dicepunks. We have fun rewards available to backers, including a patron-only Discord and access to the Dice Peaks after show for episodes 1 and following. Regardless, we hope you'll tune in again, and until then, remember, subtlety is for cowards.
Today, at the risk of wearying you of Tyr family tales, one more. Daedalus Tyr made an arm worked by ropes and pulleys to move large cargo. This was a great invention, but not, he insisted, his greatest invention. One day he affixed a second arm to a large vessel so that the arms could toss the cargo one to another. This was remarkable, of course. It meant ships no longer had to dock. Or rather, it would mean that, old Daedalus promised, once the tossing, and more irksome still, the catching, was sufficiently accurate. In the meanwhile, a fair few large empty crates and a few less than empty ones, so overeager was the old inventor, were lost. Until one day, he was adjusting the great dockside arm in some ambitious way. His son was assisting him, and accounts differ as to who it was who tightened or untightened to such a degree that the arm grabbed the son and threw him northwesterly, away from the harbor of Therit, over the horizon to who knows where. At that point, Daedalus abandoned the arm idea, and it was somewhat lost to time. It's a Dusk fact.